Well, we've been reading through the book of Daniel, and we've come to chapter 7. I explained to you last week that the book of Daniel falls neatly into two halves. The first half of the book, chapters 1 to 6, tells a series of stories about Daniel and his friends. And then the second half of the book, chapters 7 to 12, are all about different visions and prophecies which Daniel had. So the first half of the book, you have the story of Daniel, and the second half of the book, you have the prophecies of Daniel. In the first half of the book, we're introduced to Daniel, a godly young man living in Jerusalem. But then Daniel is uprooted, and he's taken off to Babylon, the capital city of the great pagan empire, ruled over by King Nebuchadnezzar. And there, Daniel stays for many years. He works as one of Nebuchadnezzar's key advisors, and then he works for the Babylonian kings that come after Nebuchadnezzar, including Belshazzar. I did say, didn't I, that Belshazzar was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. I found out since then that not all scholars agree with that. Some of them say that Belshazzar was not actually related to Nebuchadnezzar at all. I don't think it really matters in terms of what we've been looking at. But for those of you who like precision, I will simply put on record the fact that there are doubts about Nebuchadnezzar's family tree and how Belshazzar links into it. The important thing is just to understand that Daniel had to work first for Nebuchadnezzar, the greatest king that the Babylonian Empire ever had, and then he had to work for other Babylonian kings who came after Nebuchadnezzar. And then he was called in to give advice to Belshazzar, the last king of Babylon. It was while Belshazzar was ruling over Babylon that an army of Medes and Persians came and invaded the Babylonian Empire and attacked the city of Babylon and captured it and killed Belshazzar. And Darius the Mede became king of Babylon. And Daniel, who had been working for the Babylonians all this time, now became a key man in the empire of the Medes and the Persians. What I want you to see is this. Daniel was right at the heart of government for 60-odd years. He was a top civil servant. He was a government advisor for two of the greatest empires the world has ever seen. There was nobody closer to Nebuchadnezzar than Daniel was. There's no one closer to King Darius than Daniel was. Daniel was right there at the heart of government. He knew everything there is to know about how government works, about what goes on behind the scenes, about what motivates kings and rulers. Daniel could see for himself what these great men were really all about. He could understand the ideology that drove the rulers of the greatest empires in the world. We're not allowed to see most those things most of the time, are we? You know, we see different governments passing different laws and introducing different policies. We see them muddling along and responding to this trend, having to handle that crisis, sometimes making a good job of it, sometimes making a bad job of it, sometimes doing things we like, sometimes doing things that we hate. We see those things, what make up the headlines. But it's difficult to get the big picture. To understand what's behind it all. Difficult to see the wood for the trees. But Daniel was put there by God, right in the heart of these great empires. And he was taught by the Spirit of God, so that he was in a unique position to understand what really drove the men who were out to rule the world. God gave him an incredible insight into what's really going on in history. Why countries rise and fall. What the pattern is behind it all. Daniel could learn from his experiences. He'd actually come face to face with the most powerful men in the world. He'd had to negotiate with them. He'd had to advise them and to preach to them. At times he'd had to clash with them. He'd had to suffer at their hands. That's what the first six chapters of the book are all about. What Daniel learned from his own experience of human governments, human rulers. What Daniel learned about states and societies. What did Daniel learn? Well, we talked about it last week. Daniel learned that human beings everywhere, ever since Adam, have been fighting against God. That they've been trying to put themselves into God's place. That they've been trying to make God redundant. They've been trying to write God out of the story. And whether it's conscious or not, that obsession, that hatred of God, shapes and affects the way that rulers think. It affects the way that governments and states behave. There's that danger with every human government, that it will start trying to put itself into God's place. That it will expect people to worship the state, or the ruler, or the society, or the empire. That they'll expect people to worship man himself. It's a bias, it's a tendency that's there underneath all the time. It's there right back at the beginning of history, when the first great civilization was formed at Babel, Babel. And people said, let's build ourselves a city and a tower that will reach up to heaven. Let's turn ourselves into gods. And that tendency has been there ever since. And at times that tendency becomes more than just a tendency. At times that tendency becomes a conscious policy. You get particular governments which openly say, you must worship us. You must worship the emperor. You must worship the Führer. You must worship the fatherland. You must worship the state. You must worship human values. Daniel saw that happen in Babylon when Nebuchadnezzar set up his giant statue and said, everyone must worship the statue I've set up. It was a giant symbol of Nebuchadnezzar himself and his empire and man's own greatness. And Nebuchadnezzar was saying, everyone must acknowledge that man himself is supreme, and I'm the supreme man. Daniel saw it happen again when the Medes and Persians took over. Darius passed that law saying, for the next 30 days, no one must pray to any god. If they want to pray, they pray to me. I'm capable of answering all their prayers. I'm capable of meeting all their needs. Who needs God? That's what that law meant, wasn't it? Do you see, Daniel has seen it all. He's seen it close up. He knows that that is there in the heart of sinful human beings. We don't want to worship God. We don't want to worship the real God. The God who holds our life in his hands. We're running away from God. That's why human beings everywhere set up all sorts of false religions. They're just a substitute, so that people don't have to worship the real God. But beyond all those religions, human beings have this constant tendency to worship human beings, to worship humanity, So they set up rulers and emperors and superpowers, and then they expect those rulers, they expect the state to meet all their needs. And they're willing to worship the state. They'll promise it absolute loyalty and love and obedience. Do you know that famous quote from G.K. Chesterton? When men cease to believe in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. And that's true enough, but it's equally true that when men cease to worship God, they don't worship nobody, they worship anybody. They won't worship the God who made the heavens and the earth, but they'll worship Nebuchadnezzar. They won't worship the God who's written his law on their hearts, but they'll worship Mao Zedong and treat his little red book as holy writ. They hate the thought of God looking into their minds and their hearts. They won't worship him. They'll allow a human government to monitor every phone call they make and every email they send. They'll accept that and they'll worship that government, providing that the government gives them plasma TVs and free healthcare and makes it possible for them to exercise their sexual choices any time they choose, with anyone they choose, without any fear of consequences. Providing the government can say, we'll meet your needs, we'll give you everything you crave. Then they'll treat the government as God. That's how deep human antagonism to the real God goes. Anything rather than worship him. Anything rather than trust him. Anything rather than obey him. People will look to a human government to solve all their problems and to meet all their needs. You tell them to kneel before God who made the universe. You tell them to trust him alone. And they think you're either being funny or that you've gone off your head. A blank look comes over their faces. They can't compute that thought. People will devote their lives to a country, to a political system. They'll devote their lives to humanity. And they'll be thought of as great for doing that. But then you tell people that you're determined to devote your life to God, who made us, and who gave us our breath. And they look at you as if you're mad. People everywhere are hiding from God. Like rebellious teenagers who want to pretend that mum and dad don't exist, or just don't matter. And then they've got to find something else to fill the gap. Well, again and again in history, people have turned to the state, to the emperor, to the government, to the human race itself, and have said, you be my God. You meet all my needs. And I'll do anything you say. Well, Daniel, as I say, has seen all of this firsthand. He's seen it from his own experience. And that's chapters 1 to 6. But not just that. He's understood it. He's been given special help from the Spirit of God to understand these things. What you've got in chapters 7 to 12 is God helping Daniel to understand all of this. It's God giving Daniel special help to see it all from God's standpoint. You've got all these visions and prophecies given to Daniel by God. God is showing Daniel just what human history is all about. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. That was an important year. Remember, the great age of Nebuchadnezzar had passed. Since then, the Babylonian Empire had been in decline. Belshazzar was ruling in Babylon, and he was going to be the last Babylonian king. The time was at hand for the Babylonian Empire to pass away, and a new empire was rising to dominate the world. Quite literally, the writing was on the wall for the Babylonian Empire. And Daniel knew it. Daniel knew about the Persian Empire, the Persian armies massed for invasion. He knew that Babylon was going to fall. He knew that the Medes and the Persians were going to be taking over. You can imagine Daniel very tense, wondering what it's all going to mean. What will a world dominated by the Medes and Persians be like? Will it be a better world? Will it be a more humane world? Or will it be a more barbaric world? Will it be a more dangerous world? Who knows? You know, times of change are unnerving times, aren't they? They're scary times. And at scary times, at unnerving times, we have dreams. And Daniel had a dream. But this was no ordinary dream. This was a dream sent by God. Visions passed through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He saw things, true things, real things, things which only God could have shown him. And he says later when he woke up, he wrote down a summary of his dream. This is what Daniel said. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. It must have been terrifying, that dream. On the whole, Jewish people avoided the sea. The sea was frightening. The sea was threatening. It was unpredictable. They liked to have their 2 feet on dry land. And for them, the Lake of Galilee was a sea. It was as much of a sea as they wanted to explore anyway. And Daniel, remember, has been living in the deserts of Iraq for the last 60 years. But here in his dream, he sees the sea. And it's not just some little channel like the Sea of the English Channel, where you can see the coast on the far side. He sees the great sea. He sees the vast ocean. He sees the fathomless depths of the great abyss. He's there in the midst of it. And a storm is brewing. An immense, terrifying storm. From all quarters, the winds are blowing, howling, and the great sea is being churned up. Great walls of water are being raised up and then come crashing down. Huge tidal waves are sweeping across the whole ocean. In his dream, Daniel is seeing the great ocean of history. He's seeing the nations of the world driven in all directions, being tossed by great, unpredictable, uncontrollable forces. And it's frightening. He's living at one of the great crisis points of history. The fall of the Babylonian Empire. The rise of the Persian Empire. He's living through a great storm. But what he's seeing in his dream is that this is a storm that's going to go on and on and on. In one sense, history is going to be one long storm. He's being warned, and we're being warned. Don't look for stability. Don't look for tranquility here in this world. It's a pipe dream that we're ever going to have a world at peace. The ocean of history is always going to be in turmoil. And then Daniel sees something more. He sees something emerging out of the churning waters of human history. A huge beast. And then another huge beast lurches out of the water. And then a third. And finally a fourth. One after another. And Daniel says they were each different from the others. Now we're going to jump forward in the chapter to find out what these beasts are. Daniel's only told later what those beasts represent. We can find out now what he was going to learn later. In verse 17 we're told, the four great beasts are four kingdoms that will rise from the earth. Daniel sees that human history is going to produce four great empires, and each one of them is going to be a beast. They're different from each other. They look different. They've got different strengths and weaknesses. They move differently. They operate differently. But they're all beasts. They're all savage, monstrous creatures. What's Daniel being told? What's he seeing? He's surely being told this. Don't imagine, don't even hope that this world will ever be safe. That it will ever be a world where human beings are able to live as human beings were designed to live. Don't imagine it'll ever be a world where God is honoured as he ought to be honoured. A world where righteousness and justice prevail. The world in which God's people live is going to be dominated by four beastly empires. As long as this world exists, God's people in this world must expect to find beasts in control. It's just that the beasts will take different shapes. You can see why these great empires are described as beasts, can't you? Said it already in previous weeks. Human beings want to think of themselves as gods, as superhuman. They want to think that they can build societies where human beings live like gods. But Daniel is being reminded that in reality, people in these societies will behave like beasts. And the rulers who run these societies will act like beasts. The more people think of human beings as gods, the more beastly those people actually become. Four great empires. The first, Daniel says, was like a lion. This is verse 4, and it had the wings of an eagle. Once Daniel's got the clue that these beasts are empires, he'll know straight away which empire this is. It's the first great human empire. It's the one that began at the Tower of Babel. It's the Empire of Babylon. And it's lasted right up to Daniel's day. It's had its ups and downs, but it's still there. And it's like a lion. It's irresistible. It's a lion with wings. It's a lion that can go anywhere. A lion that thinks it can fly to heaven. You know, you can still go to the British Museum and you can see statues from Babylon. Statues of winged lions. The Babylonians love to think of Babylon in that way. Well, Daniel says, I watched it. That's what he's done. He's watched the Babylonian Empire through its final phase. I watched it until its wings were torn off. There was a point at which the Babylonian Empire stopped thinking of itself as a god, stopped thinking it could fly to heaven. He says it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. When was that? Well, it was surely when Nebuchadnezzar humbled himself and became a worshipper of the true God. And when he did that, he became a real man instead of being a beast. And for a little while, the beast of Babylon had a human heart. But it was only for a very short time. And the empire itself remained a beast. There was just one man who was different. But when you looked at the men who followed him, you're still talking about a beastly empire. Well, after Babylon comes a second empire. Daniel sees a second creature. It's the empire that was already waiting in the wings. The empire of the Medes and Persians. And Daniel says it looked like a bear, verse 5. A huge, shambling creature. Nothing noble or splendid about this empire. just huge. And that was the way it was. A Persian army on the march could mean millions of men. And this bear was raised up on one side. The empire was supposed to be a partnership between Medes and Persians, but the Persian side was much more powerful than the other. So the beast was lopsided. And it says this beast had three ribs in its mouth. In Daniel's vision, he can see that it's torn apart three other creatures. And now he's chewing up their bones. The Persians, in turn, swallowed up the Lydian kingdom, the Egyptian kingdom, Babylon itself, and chewed them up. And this is what the words are that are spoken to the beast: get up, eat your fill of flesh. That was what the Persian Empire was going to do. It was just going to devour everything in its path and exploit them and turn them into food for itself. It's a horrifying picture of an empire that lives only to devour its neighbours, to crush them. And then empire number three is going to come. Verse 6. Another beast, one that looked like a leopard. A leopard, verse 6, with four wings like those of a bird. So it's incredibly swift moving. It's able to fly in all directions. It's the empire of Greece under Alexander the Great and then his successors. It was the Greeks who destroyed the power of Persia. Alexander built an army that was more swiftly moving than any army in history. And that was why it had such extraordinary successes. He seemed to have an almost a magician's touch to move his army hundreds of miles in swift assaults on one nation after another. And the Greeks destroyed the power of the Persians. And they became the third great empire to rule over God's people. This beast, this leopard beast, had four heads. Because after Alexander the Great, the empire was split up into four different generals. And it was very different. Very different from the Babylonian or the Persian empires. This was the empire of culture, of philosophy, of art, of sculpture, of drama. But it's still a beast. And this beast is given authority to rule. But then, says Daniel, verse 7, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. He said back in verse 2 that his visions came at night, but now he emphasizes it again that this was a night vision. This was a nightmare. This was a vision of darkness. And it was the most terrifying of them all. An empire that was very powerful, that was utterly irresistible, that ground everything before it. Large iron teeth, crushing and devouring its victims, and sparing nothing, trampling underfoot whatever was left. Different from all the former beasts. Which empire is this? It's the empire that destroyed Greece. It's the empire of Rome. It's the empire of the Caesars. And it's the empire that still exists today. Rome split up into many different centres of power. In the end, the line of the emperors came to an end. But there's never been another empire that's taken the place of Rome. And Rome, the institutions of Rome have become the institutions of Europe and the institutions of the Western world and the institutions of the whole earth. Wherever you go in the world, you'll find people dressed in Western suits, sitting at computers designed by Western technology and voting using voting systems that sprang from the Roman Empire. The world of Rome gave birth to our world. And we have exported to the whole earth our philosophy and our systems of government and our science and our technology, even our sports. And the games that are played by people all over the world are competitive games that arose in the Roman Empire, in the Western world. Yes, the Empire of Rome splits into many horns. Daniel sees this. It was different from all the other beasts. It has 10 horns. You can see it, its power shared between Washington and Paris and London. You can see it. You can see its diversity now. But it's still one beast. And it's the most terrifying of them all. And it's the beast that, in Daniel's vision, is going to be there till the end of history. World that emerged from Rome is our world, and it's the world as we're going to know it till Christ comes again. Now Daniel, in his vision, sees something that he finds most terrifying of all. He's looking at this great beast with its 10 horns. Perhaps it's a mercy that it has 10 horns, that its power is split into lots of little powers. But then he sees another horn coming into play in verse 8. And it's only a little one, but it comes up among the 10. And it uproots 3 others. So it becomes dominant. It becomes more powerful than all the others. And this horn has eyes like the eyes of a man. In other words, it's the power of a single personality. And it has a mouth that speaks boastfully. He's going to tell us more about the boasts of this little horn later on in the chapter. He's going to talk about how this little horn, verse 20, becomes more imposing than the others. It has eyes, it has a mouth that speaks boastfully, and it wages war against the saints, and it defeats them. As I read this chapter, it's telling me that there's going to come an individual who is going to have immense power, who's going to have more power than any man since the great Roman emperors. But his power is going to be over all the earth. And that's emphasized that in verse 23 onwards, that this fourth kingdom will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth. The empires of Babylon and Greece, of Persia and Greece, they were geographically limited. They ruled over the places where God's people were living. But in our gospel age, God's people are living over the whole earth. And so this empire is going to extend its power over the whole earth. And this one horn, this little horn, is going to have the power to assault God's people wherever they are. He's going to wage war against the saints. He's going to defeat them. There's no illusions here that God's people are going to succeed in holding back this little horn when he rises. No, he's going to fight against them. He's going to persecute them and he's going to defeat them. Anybody looking at the scene on earth will say the church, God's people, have been defeated. They've been crushed. This little horn has succeeded in destroying and devouring them. That's the way it's going to look at the end. No wonder Daniel is shaken by his vision. It seems so bleak. It really is a nighttime vision. Just one monstrous empire leading to the next, leading to the next, leading to the next. And then that empire growing until it fills the whole earth and becomes dominated by one monstrous figure who attacks God's people wherever they are and crushes them underfoot and defeats them. Are we ready for this? Are we ready for a vision as black as this? Can we believe that that is where history is going here in this world? All people who want to tell us that things are getting better and better. Even some Christians who want to tell us that we can be optimistic about future events here on earth. That life here on earth is just going to get better and better, and the church is going to have more and more influence, and we're going to see a Christianized world. That isn't what we have here. What we have here are four empires, each more powerful and each worse than the one before, and culminating in this monstrous fourth empire and its horrible horn, who tramples on God's people and wages war against them and defeats them. We read of him in verse 25, he will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. And the saints will be handed over to him for a time, and times, and half a time. They'll go through a time of such persecution. And they say, well, surely this can't go on. The time is at an end now. But then they'll find that there are more times, that his oppression just seems to go on and on and on. I'm not saying that this will be in our lifetime. It may be. It may not be. What I'm saying is that that is the vision of future history here in this world that the prophet puts before us. No wonder he says in verse 15, I was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. Why then is Daniel given this vision? Well, first, to deliver him from any false hopes, any false optimism. But is that all? No. Because though there is no room for false hope, false optimism, yet this vision does not end in the darkness. It doesn't end in the grim shadows. This vision ends with an explosion of light, an explosion of glory. When Daniel has looked at the four beastly empires of history, then he is allowed to catch a glimpse of the end of history. He sees the Ancient of Days taking his seat. The one who was there before all the empires of the world were born. The empires of the world come and they grow and they die. But there is one who is the Ancient of Days, who is eternal, who is unspeakably old, who was there from eternity and will be there to eternity to come, the living God. He takes his seat. And after all the darkness and after all the shadows of the chapter, we read his clothing was as white as snow. And the hair of his head was white like wool. And his throne is flaming with fire. And its wheels were all ablaze. And a river of fire was flowing, coming out before him. Suddenly, where there was only darkness and grim shadows, suddenly there is blazing light. Suddenly there's glory flowing in all directions. Because at last God has brought history to an end. At last God has taken his place on the throne. At last he's decided to sweep away the beasts, the empires of men, the thrones that they've set up. He's there. His court is called. He is going to judge the world. And how is he going to judge the world? In my vision at night, verse 13, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. Jesus Christ is led into the presence of the Ancient of Days. He comes wrapped round with the cloud of divine glory, and he's given authority, glory, and sovereign power. At last, the beasts are no more, and a real man is reigning. The Son of Man, the perfect man, the one who shines with the glory of God, the one who is the perfect image, the likeness of God. He's the final word of history. His dominion is an everlasting dominion. This won't happen by some process of natural evolution. It won't happen simply through things getting better naturally and by some sort of inevitable program of improvement. It's not like that. This is God bringing history to an end. This is God bringing his own Son back from heaven. This is God putting Jesus Christ at his right hand and saying, rule, reign, smash your enemies. Make the universe new. And that's what we're looking for. That's what we're waiting for. We're looking at history. We're looking at the pages of our newspapers. We're listening to the news bulletins, and our hearts fail us with fear, and we say this world is becoming a more and more frightening place. We're saying it's frightening to see the powers that men are gaining for themselves. It's frightening to see the way in which governments can establish surveillance over every citizen. It's terrifying to see the way they can manipulate the very stuff of life. We find these things frightening, don't we? We find it frightening to see the network of the nations becoming stronger and closing in so that there's no hiding place for anybody. These things are frightening. We feel frightened. These are nighttime visions of darkness. We see the last beast becoming more and more clear in his appearance. We know that one day that little horn is going to appear, and that then really will come a dark hour for God's people. But beyond all that, we see a dawn. We see a dawn because we see the Lord Jesus coming in the clouds of heaven. And we see the sky being rolled away. And we see the glory of the world to come breaking in. And we see the river of fire that burns up all God's enemies. And we see Jesus Christ reigning. And we see his people, the saints of the Most High, sharing his throne. And we say, this is the future. This is the reality. The visions that Daniel has seen are the dark shadows before the dawn. But there will come a dawn, and it will usher in a day that will last forever. Everlasting joy, everlasting peace, everlasting justice, everlasting righteousness, when Jesus Christ, the Son of Man, sits on the throne of the universe, sits on the throne of this earth, sits with his people gathered around him. That's our hope, that's our expectation, that's our comfort, that's our joy. Reading the newspapers is dangerous. For us as Christians, because we can sink into an abyss of despair and discouragement and fear. It can become paralyzing. Just keeping track of what's going on in the world can become debilitating. Unless we close our newspapers when we finish reading them and open this book. Unless we look beyond passing events and see where it's all going to. The Lamb wins. The Lord Jesus Christ is going to be the conqueror. He's going to be the one who will reign. and will reign forever and ever.